You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
That's my Russian. I'm David Burwell, and I direct the Energy and Climate Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C. And for those who have not met him, I want to introduce Adnan Vattenserver, who directs the Russia program for the Energy and Climate team at Carnegie. And thank you for coming and being part of this conversation and the Russia-Eurasian launch of the Global Adaptation Index, a brand new index on how the public and private sector can adapt and invest most strategically in light of the context of climate change. I want to congratulate all of you for being here. How many of you folks attended the G8 summit? Was it G8 on climate adaptation that was over the last 3 days? Did anybody here attend that? Nobody attended that. That's interesting. We had a three-day conference. I can tell all the jokes then that they said at the conference. Anyway, 650 people, 33 countries have spent the last 3 days talking about the reality of global climate change and the response of the world in adapting to climate change. And in that context, to inform the response to climate change, there have been several indexes published by scientists and experts on how the world can respond to the reality of climate change, because it is happening, and it is happening now. Most of these indexes are really vulnerability indexes. How vulnerable is the world to climate change? What are the most vulnerable regions that are going to have the most specific impact? And where are the places that we have to be most concerned? And the nature of the concern, whether it's lack of water, lack of food, health impacts from climate change. That's the nature of most of these indexes. The index you will hear today is about the response on how business and public leaders can invest very limited capital on most strategically addressing these problems. We have three very expert and distinguished speakers today. We will have first Dr. Juan Jose Daboob. Dr. Daboob is the founding and chief executive of the Global Adaptation Index. He is the former managing director of the World Bank, where he oversaw operations of the World Bank in 110 different countries, and was also the former finance minister of El Salvador. This is, as I said, the third launch of this index. It's been launched in Washington, D.C. This fall, and also Mexico for Latin America, and this is the launch for Russia-Eurasia. After Dr. Daboob presents the index, we'll have two responses. The first one, we're going to change the schedule of speakers. Dr. Oleg Anisimov, who's the director of the State Hydrological Institute in St. Petersburg, will give a response to the index and anything else he would like to talk about. He's holding his options open. Dr. Anisimov was also an author of the third, fourth, and fifth IPCC climate report. It is the member of the organization who got the Nobel Peace Prize for these reports. He's a member of the working group number two, which focuses on the impacts of climate change. After him, we will have Dr. Mikhail Yulkin. He's the director of the Environment Investment Center, which is a business organization here in Moscow. He's also the CEO of a organization that provides global services on climate change impacts, climate change assessments, footprints, and other services to major corporations on how major corporations can deal with climate change. After that, we will open it up for questions and discussion at about 5:25. I think I'd like to just say one more thing before our speakers speak, and I'd like to speak a bit personally. It's my first time in Moscow and dealing with climate issues. From a personal perspective, my exposure to this issue and to the environment was long ago. When I was 50 years ago, I was a young boy, and as young boys do, I had a hero, and my hero was John F. Kennedy. He was the new president of the United States, and a speech in his first year, 50 years ago, when a time when America and Russia were not on as good terms as they are today, he gave a speech on why these two nations should work together, and his three reasons were: we all drink the same water, we all breathe the same air, and we're all mortal. And his point was that there are, of course, as human beings, there are more things that connect us than that separate us, and that we should dedicate our lives to focusing on the problems and the issues that connect us, not the things that separate us. Very impressionable. I took that into account. He started the Peace Corps. I joined the Peace Corps, spent 2 years in Africa, and realized the truth of what he said. 25 years after that speech, I was a young lawyer, and in my hometown, where there are many it's a scientific community, and one of the scientists mentioned to me this concept of climate change, and I had not heard about it, and I said, what are the implications of this? And he said, well, the Earth is going to get a lot warmer. We don't know what the implications are, but we'll probably lose the polar bears. And being very sad about that, I said, you know, polar bears are innocent. Why should we live in a world without polar bears? I then decided to be an environmental lawyer. I worked for an environmental organization for many years trying to save wildlife habitat and saving animals that were not affected or had no responsibility for this this effect. This year, the scientist who I had this discussion with is now the scientific advisor to the President of the United States. His name is John Holdren, and he's very concerned about climate change. And he gave a speech this year in which he said, there are three ways the world and we as humans can respond to climate change. Number one, we can try to mitigate it. We can try to stop it from happening. We can slow it down and try to deal with a world where we do not warm the atmosphere to the point of losing animals and human health and having these other impacts. Second, we can adapt, and that's what we're talking about today. How can we adapt to the inevitable consequences of climate change? The third way we can deal with it is that we can suffer. And he said, even if we stop putting carbon in the atmosphere tomorrow, no coal, no oil, no gas, no deforestation, no more emissions into the atmosphere starting tomorrow, we will still need to mitigate, we will still need to adapt, and we will still suffer. And I think of that often, because I take with me everywhere I go a picture of my granddaughter, who is just 2 years old. And her name is Anastasia, and she's half Russian and half American. And she's innocent as well. But in 50 years from now, it's not us who are going to suffer. It's our children and our grandchildren. And if we don't deal with this issue immediately, that suffering is going to increase. So this is a very important reason for why this particular meeting is important, and in this particular country where the issue is so important, and I thank you for coming. And with that, I will turn this over to Dr. Daboob for the presentation on the Global Adaptation Index.
Thank you, David. Good afternoon. I also like to thank Carnegie Endowment for inviting me to this event. For the Global Adaptation Institute, this is a fantastic opportunity to be in Moscow, to be launching the index, the Global Adaptation Index from Moscow. Let me start by making sure that we are clear about what I will be talking about today. I have spent about one third of my life in the private sector, one third of my life in academia, and one third of my life in government. I was for 12 years in the government of my country without belonging to any political party then or now. I worked for three different administrations. And the reason I'm telling you this is that as a former minister of finance in my country, I learned that governments are always thinking about what is urgent and not necessarily what is important. Sometimes the two things go together, but not always. I also learned that politicians are always thinking about the next election and not the next generation. And that's a reality that we have to learn to live with. From the private sector perspective, where I have spent about a third of my life, and I continue to be in many private organizations, it is very important to understand the public policies that are put in place from the public sector side to have a certain degree of predictability and to understand what kind of investments you can make and have a decent return on investment. From the academic world, I learned that we need to be as scientifically as sound, but also as pragmatic as possible in whatever topic it is that we are trying to address. Today, the conversation is about adaptation to climate change and other major global trends. And this is very important. A lot of people now for many years have been talking about mitigation, which is important, and we hope a lot of success takes place on the mitigation side. But we are focused on adaptation, which is the parallel track that we need to act today. And that especially for developing countries, it is a little bit easier for politicians, for people in the private sector, and people in the academic world to understand and to do something about it. Because it has to do with food, agriculture, energy, water, and coastal protection. So it doesn't matter if I'm speaking to President Museveni of Uganda or President Kagame of Rwanda, or if I'm speaking to the president of my country, or I'm speaking to anybody from the private sector in those parts of the world. They understand that there are 7 billion mouses to feed, 7 billion people that need food, that need water. There are a lot of people that still doesn't have energy, any kind of energy. Actually, in Africa, excluding South Africa, less than 5% of the population have access to energy. So when you go to those countries, if you start talking only about mitigation, they are very polite and they say yes, 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 but they won't do much about it because 95% of the population doesn't even have access to energy, for example. So the kind of solutions that need to be put out there need to be pragmatic and need to be results-oriented. And that's what I like to talk to you about. The world is changing, and it's changing faster than ever. Mitigation is not working at the speed or at the pace that people would like it to see working. Copenhagen was a failure. There was nothing in Cancun, Mexico, and Durban in 2 weeks, I don't think is going to reach any kind of agreement. There is not going to be global agreement, I think, in the short term. Adaptation, therefore, is essential and urgent. The Global Adaptation Institute was founded less than a year ago, December 1 of last year. It's the only organization, non-for-profit, non-political organization, exclusively focused on the topic of adaptation. And this is our mission and our vision. We would like to enhance the world's understanding of the urgency to adaptation to climate change and other global forces, and for the urgent need for the private sector to invest in those areas. In order to do that, we are working in three different areas. First, which is the one I will invest most of my time today, is the Global Adaptation Index, which has to do with developing matrix, developing a way to measure how well or how poor countries are doing in terms of adapting to the effects of climate change. Second, we are financing demonstrative pilot projects, which we hope can be scaled up and can be marketable so that the private sector can realize and do the investments. And third, we are working, as this exercise today, on education and outreach. Let me share a few facts that probably won't come as a surprise to you. But urbanization, population growth, and economic development has been happening and will continue to happen in the future. I actually think that we shouldn't be worried about population growth. Each individual can produce more than what he or she can consume. As long as there are clear rules of the game, as long as there is freedom, people will find innovative solutions to the most complex problems. Now, as you can see from the line, there is a significant trend, an increment yearly in terms of the percentage of people that is affected by climate-related disasters. And this is, again, as I was saying before, no news for many countries, certainly not for El Salvador, my country, where 88% of its territory is highly vulnerable. We have an earthquake, a big one, every 14 years, and we have a tropical storm every year, and every year we lose people, we lose land, we lose the livelihood of a lot of people. Today, the estimates, starting from the World Bank's estimate in 2006 until just last year's estimate, there are between $30 and $100 billion every year that need to be invested in order to prepare better for the effects of climate change and other global trends. And only less than $1 billion is actually committed to that. So that gap, it doesn't matter if you take the lower number, 30 billion, or the higher number, 100 billion, there is a large gap. That gap can only be filled by the private sector. There is no government, no World Bank, no IMF, no international organization that has the kind of money that is needed. It has to come from investments done by the private sector. The governments have an important role to play, because they have the opportunity of setting the table, putting the rules of the game, and actually having strong enough institutions to regulate wherever it is necessary to regulate and to do not intervene wherever the market forces can do the work. There needs to be greater commitment by the many UN organizations and by other organizations as well. Now, with that reality, and we can talk some more about that during the Q&A, or you can go to the website of the Institute and find all of the information that I'm sharing with you, we decided that it was very important to have a way of measuring how countries were doing in terms of their level of preparedness or their readiness. And so we created this very simple matrix. It's a 2x2 matrix, which you can find in the table at the entrance, and you can take it home with you, which attempts to highlight where countries are in terms of, in the y-axis, their vulnerability, and in terms of their readiness on the x-axis. So those countries that you see in red are countries that possess a great challenge because they are highly vulnerable and they need to urgently act because they are also less prepared. The ones that are in blue are countries that have high vulnerability but are also highly prepared. That means they either have the means or can get the means to adapt to the effects of climate change and other global trends. The countries in the yellow quadrant are countries that have fewer concerns today and have more time to get ready. And the countries in the green quadrant are those countries that are less vulnerable, have less vulnerabilities, and are stronger or more prepared. In general, although when you adjust that to GDP, but in general, you find that most developing countries are somewhere in the red quadrant, and most developed countries are in the green quadrant. But there are some very interesting surprises that I will show you in a few minutes. The important thing is to try to move towards the green quadrant. We develop the Global Adaptation Tool, the Global Adaptation Index, which is a navigation chart that aims at helping decision makers in the public sector, in the private sector, and in academia to actually understand what are the vulnerabilities of his or her country and how prepared the country is and what kind of actions can be taken in order to minimize certain vulnerabilities that can be reduced and to increase the level of preparedness in those areas where it is possible to increase it. And I will come back to this with a live presentation in a few minutes. The criteria for selecting the matrix that we are using in the index is the one that you can read there. The criteria for selecting matrix is that the information needed to be transparent and come from authoritative sources, to be open access, just like the index and the website is an open access, which is that means available to everybody, structured and modular, meaning that we can use it for the pieces of information can be used for different kind of analysis, actionable, temporal, meaning in our case that we have at least 15 years, that was the criteria, that we can have at least 15 years of history, of historical information, but also that the sources that are producing this information will keep producing that information going forward. And we wanted that information to be scalable. It is right now at the national level. We want to bring it at the local level, and that's part of the work in the future. Over 1 million matrix were considered, and all of those were grouped into 38 indicators, which possess about 100,000 items of information, which you can also see in our website in a few minutes. Broadly speaking, the vulnerability measures, I'm speaking now on the y-axis, the vulnerability measures are 24, and they measure both quantitative as well as qualitative measures. In which sectors? Water, food, health, and infrastructure. Infrastructure subdivided in coastal, energy, and transport. And in the traditional way that vulnerability is measured, exposure, sensitivity, and capacity. The dots simply show which ones are qualitative and which ones are quantitative. When I mentioned that it's scalable and that the information needs to be open access, etc., is that we envision that going forward, it will be necessary, or actually anybody can add other pieces of information that might suit a particular need in a particular country, or when you go to the local level, for example, on ecosystem services, and in the infrastructure side, on urban versus rural populations. As you know, in the next 20 years, about 70% of the population of the world will be living in cities, not in the rural areas, as it is the case in many countries. But also informal settlements. This is also very important, at least for some countries. We have them in blue because we are not incorporating this information yet, but in future versions, we envision that being included. Don't worry if you cannot read this. This is just a detailed information of each of the indicators, and this information is also available on the table and is available in the website. So I won't go into details, but this is just which index is being used and from which source. All of that was on the vulnerability or the y-axis. On the x-axis, that's the readiness component or the readiness indicator. We currently have 14 indicators, and they are in the economic area, in the governance area, and in the social sector. So some of the things that are in the economic area are business freedom, fiscal strengthening of a country, monetary freedom, the investment capacity people have or businesses have in a particular country. On the governance front, we are measuring voice and accountability, political stability and nonviolence, and control of corruption. And in the social area, we are using mobiles per 100 people. Why mobiles? Because whenever there is a natural disaster, this is the first tool one uses, you know, calling a friend or calling an ambulance or calling for help. But also it's a tool that is being used in the agriculture sector for providing information to farmers that are producing products, labor freedom, tertiary education, and rule of law. These are the indicators or the measures that we are using on the readiness part. We tested the index against recent events that have taken place in the last 5 or 6 years, and without any surprise, we found that group of countries that have similar levels of risk or vulnerability have had a similar or a comparable number of lives lost. And so what you see there are correlations. A country that has a low index, a low value in the index, has a high value in terms of the numbers of deaths that have taken place. These are the rankings. And again, that information is also on the website, and it's also on the table that is out there, and it's also included in this very simple index card that has the ranking of the countries, 161 countries. We have about 190 countries total in the index, but 30 countries do not have all of the information available, so it is only partial information, but of 161 countries, you have a ranking for all of them. The countries that are in the gray color are high-income countries. The next color, the lighter gray, are the first were highest income. The next are high-income countries. In blue is upper-middle-income countries, lower-middle-income countries, and least-developed countries. So as I was saying when I described the matrix, most developed countries are at the top, meaning they are either less vulnerable or more ready, or both. And developing countries are somewhere in the bottom. So again, in the top 25 countries, most of the countries you find there are developed countries, But you are starting to see countries like Poland, Chile, and Uruguay that are also in the top 25. That means they have a good rank. That means they are either less vulnerable or more prepared than other countries. And at the bottom, you have most of the developing country. That's the low, the ones, the lowest 25 ranked countries. Now, some countries from the developing world, like Ghana and Rwanda, are climbing. They have been doing in the last 5 to 10 years some important changes on the readiness front, and that has brought them up or further from where some of their neighbor countries are. In the readiness matrix, and we will see this alive in a few minutes, this is the spreading of the countries, where red, as shown in the matrix before, are the countries that are most vulnerable and less prepared, and green are the less vulnerable and more prepared. We have also observed very important information over the last 15 years. Concretely, we have seen, and this is an example, this is the slide I used last week for Mexico, for some Latin American countries, Mexico, Chile, Nicaragua, and Uruguay. And what we are trying to portray in there is that most countries have had a trend, a positive trend in the last 15 years, meaning they have either decreased their vulnerabilities or increased the level of readiness. But there are a few countries that actually have gone backwards, and we will see that in a few minutes. We also wanted to compare all of these 161 countries with the GDP. We intentionally left from the different indicators that are used, we left out any indicator that use GDP. However, the actual outcome of the index shows, with no surprise, that there is a very strong correlation to GDP. So what we decided to do was, okay, so what happens with some of the countries that are above the trend? Why are they above the trend? What have they done which puts them in a better position than countries with comparable GDP? And we will see in a few minutes the answer. When we adjust to GDP, you remember the top 25 countries of the world were mostly developed countries, with the exceptions of Poland, Uruguay, and Chile. When you adjust the index to GDP, you see in the top 20 countries of the world, many countries, which are, you know, in purple, in light blue, or in gray, that are not developed countries. Yet, in the last 15 years, they have moved faster or have done more changes to reduce vulnerability or to increase preparedness than countries with a comparable level of development. So Kyrgyzstan comes as number one. Yes. Now, we're not suggesting that that's the first place one will go to invest. What we're suggesting is that that particular country is less vulnerable than many other countries, either because the other countries have not improved their readiness or have not reduced their vulnerability. We still have many developed countries here, like Denmark, New Zealand, Switzerland, Finland, and Australia. But you have many developing countries coming up to the top. Now, why is this important? This is important because when you talk with people from the private sector that are looking to make investments outside their countries, they tend to look at the safest or the one with the lowest risk. What we're trying to say is do not only look at those, but also pay attention to other countries that are, first, they have challenges, but at the same time, they have an environment that is conducive for investments in the areas related to adaptation. There is an important role for the public sector to continue to play. They understand where the greatest challenges are, where the most vulnerable are. It is important also for governments to determine and efficient use of certain resources. They understand the relative urgency of the population, and they can remove the impediments that do not allow the private sector to invest. For the private sector, the roles that they can play are from the development of new products and services to help in risk mitigation and risk reduction, corporate social responsibility, and ecosystems and environmental markets. We have identified over 270 projects throughout the world, and there are thousands. These are the ones we have been able to identify. We have profiled 10 of them, and we will be providing resources to them in the next few months, with the idea that universities, governments, and the private sector actually also work in those projects to help show how the needle in terms of adaptation can point in a better or a stronger direction. This is the selection criteria for projects. I won't get into those details, but something that is very important is that we want to be able to show that these areas of investment are scalable and marketable. Let me now show you the index, because I have only exactly 8 more minutes. When you go to the website, which is gain.globalai.org, and it's again available there, what you will see is what we are seeing here is a map of all the countries of the world, and you can just go on top of any country. This is Algeria, this is Brazil. You see the ranking, that's the gain value, the global adaptation index value for Brazil, for the United States, and for Russia is 63. So also the website, I'm going to come back to Russia. In the website, in the first page, you can find an explanation about the methodology that we are using, which is what I was describing to you. You can also see the map corrected to GDP, that is adjusted to GDP. You can also see the top 5 and the bottom 5 countries, and you can view the full ranking, and we're going to do that in a few minutes. And we are also featuring countries every week. So this week, we are featuring Russia and Mexico. Mexico, because we launched the index in Latin America last week from Tecnológico de Monterrey in Mexico, and today because we are here in Russia. And we tell you a little bit more about the institute. And you can go also here. That's the window at the bottom, and you can put the name of any country you want to actually see the information. So let me go now to Russia. So immediately, it shows me the country and the neighboring countries. It gives me the rank. The Russian Federation is ranked number 82 in the index with a score of 63. And we also have a trend, which in this case is not positive. It's a trend in the wrong direction. Russia is also in the yellow quadrant in the matrix, and we can see all of that information in more detail. But from this very quick snap picture in the website, you also see what have been the behavior of Russia in the last 15 years in terms of its vulnerability and its readiness. So starting in 1995, Russia has climbed, has advanced, has progressed, but in the last few years, from 2006, you see that there has been a small drop. And one can say, which are the dominant areas? So you go to the part here that says the vulnerability composition. On vulnerability, you see that food accounts for about 37% of the vulnerability of the country, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. After food is water. After water is health. And finally, less relevant, but also infrastructure. In terms of its readiness, the most important component of readiness is on the social front, and we will see in a few minutes what does that entail. After that is on the economic front, and finally on the governance front. So in the case of Russia, I want to see the whole profile of the country. And so we get a larger picture, and we see that Russia, it gives information about the GDP per capita, the population, in this case as of 2009, and you can get all of the information from 1995 until 2010 on the vulnerability front or on the readiness front. So right now we are looking at vulnerability. The components of vulnerability are food, water, health, and infrastructure. So if we were to look under food, we want to see what has happened in terms of food capacity. We push the button of food capacity, and you see that a description that says, in the case of Russia, food capacity measures the agricultural technological capacity as the average of the two best scores from the uses of fertilizers, the level of mechanization, and the use of irrigation in agriculture. And what you want in the case of vulnerability, you want the arrow to go down. So in this case, OPPO is going in the wrong direction. You are more vulnerable in the area of food than other countries are. And this is information reported from the World Development Indicators, the on in terms of fertilizers consumption, agricultural machinery, and irrigable land. The index also compares you to other countries. So in the case of food capacity, who is Russia comparable to? Well, it's comparable to Guinea, Dominica, Mongolia, Djibouti, and St. Lucia. Those are the countries that have a comparable ranking in terms of food capacity. And because of time, I won't go into all of the details, but I invite you to do that. Let me, however, look at the readiness. So on the readiness front, you see a positive trend. In this case, you want the arrow or you want the trend to go upwards. On vulnerability, you want it to come down. On readiness, you want it to go up. And it is going up. And that's a good sign. And for example, when we look at the economic part, if we were to look, I'm just going to choose monetary freedom, for example. In monetary freedom, from 1995 to about year 2002, you were going up and down. Now you have gone a little bit higher and have stabilized at about 0.6-0.7%. And again, who do you compare with? Well, Russia compares in that case to Ukraine, Argentina, Kyrgyzstan, Belarus, and Angola. Those countries have a similar rating as Russia does. And you can see as much information as you want related to Russia. Let me quickly show you something that I'm sure you're going to like, which is the matrix. And you see the gray dot shows each country. That's Sierra Leone. I'm pointing now at Senegal. In this quadrant is Botswana. In this other is Azerbaijan. And here is Republic of Korea. And so again, in line with what I said before, the red quadrant are those countries that are most vulnerable and less prepared. These are countries that are highly vulnerable but are better prepared. These are countries with low preparedness and low vulnerability. And these are countries with low vulnerability and high level of preparedness. So in this part of the tool, you can also do an exercise. You can do. You can put countries and compare them against each other. So let's put Russia. Let's put. Give me countries that you are interested with. Shall we put Brazil? Can anybody just give me a couple of names that, of countries that you would like to put here? Mexico.
Germany.
Germany. Okay. Any other country? So, in 2010, you can see where the United States is, where Germany is, where Brazil is, and where Russia is. Let me make it a little bit more interesting. Let me add India. So I'm adding the BRICS, China, North Korea. I don't think there is information on North Korea because there is no information available of the last 15 years. They are still working on it. Another country? Okay. So, in 2010, again, the U.S., Germany, Brazil, Russia, Ukraine, China, and India. Now, let's look at where they were in 1995. In 1995, there were only two countries, you can guess which ones, were better prepared or less vulnerable, or both. That was the United States and Germany. The United States and Germany. Whereas in the yellow quadrant, we have Brazil, Russia, the Ukraine. And in the red quadrant, or the worst positions, we have China and India. Now, let's see what happened in the last 15 years. You see how the countries were moving. And you will see that some of them moved forward. Others gave two steps forwards and one step backwards. India hasn't moved too much. China has moved from red to yellow. Most of the others have moved to yellow. And Brazil moved to green. The United States and Germany didn't move too much. That means they haven't significantly progressed, but they are also in a comfortable position, if you want. So the challenge are primarily for especially developing countries. And you can also see in the website the rankings of the countries. These are the rankings of all the countries of the world. You have the ranking, the name of the country, to which income group it belongs to, the trend, whether it is an stable trend, a positive trend, or a negative trend. And it gives you also a score. Now, as I said before, you can also correct this information to GDP. And when you correct the information to GDP, you will see how some of these countries change. I already showed you a slide before, so I won't spend too much time on that. But I just want to conclude with the following. You have the index. You can also rank the countries only according to their vulnerability. And David mentioned at the beginning that all of the indicators, there are 43 indicators that have been produced in the last 10 years. They only measure vulnerability, which is what is in this column. Our index measures vulnerability and readiness. It subtracts from readiness, it subtracts the vulnerabilities of the countries. And that's how the index is produced. I'm going to stop here because of time with a simple conclusion, and that is that this is a very user-friendly tool which is free and available to anybody. It's an open source. You can navigate, you can see any country you want. You can see which specific areas for each country matter in terms of reducing vulnerabilities or increasing the level of preparedness. And I will be more than happy to respond to any questions or to stay at the end and show you more tricks that this navigation tool can do. Thank you very much.